Historically, thousands of murders are classified as unsolved across the UK. Modern forensic techniques help families find justice, even after decades have passed. I'm Wednesday Clarkson. I've worked inside the underworld for more than 30 years, alongside police officers, forensic scientists, and criminals. My research has included prison visits, surveillance operations, police raids, and even post-mortems. And now I want to take you on a journey into modern forensic science. You're listening to the Real Silent Witnesses podcast from Graphic Audio, a podcast series that delves into the scientific leaps in forensics. In each episode, we'll meet forensic experts and journalists who work tirelessly to help families that deserve answers. And we'll examine the techniques that help solve the most difficult cold cases. Throughout the show, you'll hear extracts from my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses. This is The Real Silent Witnesses, Police and Forensics. Our guest today is former policeman Carl Jones, who's seen all aspects of law enforcement at close range. With him, we'll discuss the relationship between forensics and police over the decades, and we'll delve into issues about mental health for those serving in the force. Since leaving the job, Carl has concentrated on helping people cope with and reduce the stressful elements in their lives. He's also written a best-selling book called The Caveman Principles and has another book coming out shortly. Carl's experiences overlap into the world of forensic science in a way many people might not realize. As a result, Carl's opinions and experience of policing and forensics during his career offer a unique perspective on the subject. Welcome, Carl Jones.
Thanks, Wensley. Nice introduction. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Now, let's begin this account of the police attitude towards forensics and the whole stress effect by going many years back to even maybe a couple of decades before you joined the force. It's post-war Britain. Crime is thriving. The relationship between police and professional criminals is the bedrock of everything. There's almost a mutual respect between these two so-called enemies. But in the middle of all this are forensic scientists who are treated a little bit as if they're freaks, in a sense. They're not policemen, but they are investigators. And the way they were treated back then tended to be they were an irritant. And then we move forward to what happened to you many decades later and how that led you to quit the police force. I'm talking about not forensics that have dominated the Real Silent Witnesses podcast in the past, but I'm talking about forensic psychology. I'm talking about the attitude that the forensics themselves have provoked in the police down the years. I see it linking into the way they handle stress. What do you think about that?
I started as a police officer in 2000, 21 years ago. And when I started, I think this was when we called them then SOCOs, Scenes of Crime Officers. And these Scenes of Crime Officers were actually police officers who were trained to deal with things like fingerprints, any form of prints, photographing scenes, swabbing blood. What today is part of pretty much every single crime you go to. But back then, those SOCO officers would only ever come out to quite serious incidents, burglaries, serious assaults, those sorts of things.
The Scene of Crime Officers, or SOCO for short, were in a sense the middlemen between the police and the actual scientists. They were the ones that did the nuts and bolts forensic work, weren't they?
They were the ones that did the crime scene, that's right. So anything they gathered, they then sent it into the scientists. Now, when I started, the scenes of crimes were seen as almost like a secondary part of the investigation. The first part was always boots on the ground, deal with what's in front of you. And then scenes of crimes would come in and then would give you the almost like the feather in the cap. You knew who your offender was, and then they would give you the secondary evidence that you would need that the court would like. But I do appreciate that before all this, back in the 80s, when fingerprints were coming into their own, really, that their own evidential use within crime. It was never part of any investigation. The only investigation you could do was go after the offender. If you knew who it was all down to the actual coppering of investigating any crime. So it was all untested. Lots of things that went to court in regard to forensics had to go through a number of different cases before case law was actually called by a judge and could then be used later on in any other offences. So it does take time to build up.
Exactly. And I know this might sound like a strange segue, but in a way, I'm feeling that the PTSD that I believe you suffered after a particular incident, which we'll go into in a minute, and those attitudes are actually weirdly similar because, of course, what you're talking about is old-fashioned policing where the scientists doing the forensics are secondary. The effect of the crime on a police officer, such as yourself, is secondary. I know it's changing now, but would that be a fair enough overview of some years back?
Oh, absolutely. Cops back then were cops. You never complained about anything. You got on and did it. You were never allowed to show any form of fear. And the people they were dealing with, they were nasty people. So if you gave them any opportunity to come at you, they would. You know, police officers used to get attacked in their homes. There's lots of stories about big criminals actually going after the cops. And if they couldn't palm them off with a handful of money, they would come after their family. So it was all about, I'm tougher than you. And that was how it was many years ago. It was a tough job. I mean, seriously, tough job compared to what it is today. And when a lot of the cops were dealing with mental issues, they couldn't go to anybody to say that they were suffering. So they had to suffer in silence. And I think that over a number of years would have had a huge impact, even going back to if you talk about World War II, when the soldiers were coming back with shell shock. They didn't talk about it then. And I funny feeling that it was the police back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, probably the same.
And from what I've read of what happened to you, there is an element of this that occurred to you. Can you talk us through what happened to you?
Of course. So I was a police officer. As I've already said, I joined in 2000. For 11 years, I was frontline operational response. It's what I love. It's what I enjoy doing, chasing down the criminals, finding a name, finding them, arresting them, dealing with them, sending them to court. That's the whole job of what I saw as what a police officer did. I was actually the senior police officer on the team, the response team that I was part of. And everything just felt like it was my bread and butter. Nothing really fazed me. I just jumped into anything and dealt with it because pretty much I've been there and done that. However, back in 2011, I got called to a domestic, one that I thought this is just another job. I'd been to hundreds before, and I'm still probably going to go to another 100 after. So it didn't really bother me. So I turned up to a job, 2 o'clock in the morning, knocked on the door, and there was no mayhem. There was nothing apart from a woman running around in the house saying, I need to sort the baby out. So she runs off and leaves me on the doorstep, and I have no idea what's happening. So I work my way into the house and find a couple of lads sat on a sofa in the living room. And I tried talking to them. They seemed quite engaged in what you could describe as a drunken, more interested in the video game they're playing in the corner kind of thing. But they weren't rude or anything. They just kind of ignored me. I had nothing. I couldn't speak to anybody. No one was talking to me. So ultimately, I just start taking details. Whilst I'm doing this, the female comes back downstairs from upstairs. This was after she'd seen her child up there. And I managed to corner her in the kitchen and say, please tell me what's going on. You called me. I have to know what happened so that I can help you or at least deal with the situation. And she said, well, he punched me. And she points to the side of her face and she's got this big red blotch on the side of her cheek. And I said, okay, what would you like to happen? And I gave her the options. But obviously the main option was he was going to get arrested. It was whether she wanted to make a complaint or whether I took it in my hands, took basically the pressure off of her. And he was coming with me. It was just how we dealt with it afterwards. So she just nodded and I accepted that, you know, he needs to come with us. So walking back into the living room, I stand in front of the young lad. His name was Ricky. And I said to Ricky, okay, Ricky, you're coming with me. He was okay, no problem. Start putting his shoes on and he's chatting to his mate and he's saying, I'll come and find you in a few hours, you leave, and I'll sort this out. And I said, no, Ricky, you don't understand. I will be arresting you. And then with his head down by his knees, he's just shaking his head. And I'm thinking, this doesn't feel right. And he starts saying, no, 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 no. And I'm thinking, this is really odd. Perhaps he's going to get up and start fighting. So I pull out my little canister, my CS canister, and wait to see what he's doing. Whilst he's got his head down, I'm saying to him, come on, Ricky, we know how this is going to happen. You're going to need to get your shoes on and we can go and sort this out. He's still saying, no, 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 no. And for some unknown reason, I just see his hand sliding forward. And it was underneath the sofa cushion that he was sat on, which I thought was odd. I'm trying to work out what was going on. And then as he stands up and his arm comes up, he's got a handgun in his hand. It's only a coffee table between him and I. And it takes me a second to recognize what it is. But as soon as I see it, that's it. I'm completely focused on what's happening. And ultimately, I'd worked out that I'd bought a can of pepper spray to a gunfight. So didn't really have a lot to say. He's still saying, no, 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 no. And then he starts saying, I'm going to run for the hills. With that, I heard a bang. I saw the gun jolt in his hand. I saw something come out the end of the barrel. It was pointed right at my chest. I was thinking, this isn't good. But then all I could think of was, I've got to deal with this. There was no thoughts about protecting myself or anyone else. I had the young lady still stood behind me in the kitchen. There was a young baby upstairs, and I got an offender in front of me that needs to be arrested. Well, all I can think of was squeeze the trigger. So I pushed my thumb down on the pepper spray. And as I'm doing that, I see two more jolts and I hear two more bangs from the gun. And I just stand there and I just hope that I'm going to hit him with the pepper spray.
Were you feeling anything physically?
Everything slowed down. I don't actually think I thought about myself one little bit. It was just about, I've got to deal with this. I pretty much worked out in my head I was probably dead. There was no thought of anything else. I didn't feel anything physically. I just worked through the motions.
What did that feel like? Can you describe it?
It was almost numbing. It was as if I had done it 100 times before, and it was just a physical reaction to get on and do my job. I didn't think about anything else other than to get my hands on this person and to arrest him.
The gun had gone off three times by this stage. Were you aware of any physical pain?
Nothing. I'm just focused, absolutely focused. This person, he needs to be arrested. So I just kept going. And I guess in the back of my mind, I was probably going, you know, you got to keep going. You got your colleagues come in. I was pushing my emergency button on the radio. There were still other things that needed to be dealt with. And perhaps whatever I could do, I could help the next person that was coming.
But you haven't moved position yet.
I'm still stood there on the side of the coffee table, and I'm just watching him. But then before I get a chance to do anything, this dog comes out of nowhere, runs around the coffee table, and I can see his jaws wide open. It was a little Staffordshire Bull Terrier. And I see it coming up towards me. And it's only because of the stance I was in, and obviously the adrenaline was still kicking in, my leg just extended. I don't think I was in control of that. It was just a reaction. And I ended up kicking the dog. And I felt the dog's teeth brush my knuckles. That's how close it was to clamping his jaw down. And then as I look up again, his friend who was sat on the sofa has come around the coffee table and is coming at me, ready. Obviously, his fists are up, his head's down, his teeth are bared. He's been drunk. He's seen what's happening. And I knew what he was going to do. He was going to come and attack me. As his friend came at me, my elbow just came out, and as I swung back, I hit him in the chest with my elbow, and he went flying across the room, landed in the fireplace. And then it was a chance for me to look to see what else was around. And when I looked around the living room, Ricky had gone. He wasn't anywhere in sight. Ricky springs up from behind the sofa, and when he sprung up, I could see him rubbing his eyes with the back of his hands, and still in his right hand was the handgun. And there was three more bangs. So I thought, well, I'll just empty the rest of my pepper spray over him. So I just stood there and sprayed him until he went down again, or the pepper spray ran out. I really can't remember, because it was just that the whole incident felt like it was going on for at least an hour, and it was probably only minutes.
So hang on, so he shot at you six times by this stage.
In total?
In total. I'm not trying to denigrate what happened to you, but I want to move forward for a second because I can imagine everything being in slow motion to you at the time. But how do you get out of this?
I just kept doing my job, basically. So I saw him, I grabbed him, I lifted him again. The adrenaline was still going through me. I lifted him over the sofa and threw his face into the pillows and had him in handcuffs.
So you're sort of almost doing it on automatic pilot in a sense.
That's exactly what it was. That's probably the best way to describe it. And it wasn't until I got out of the house that I even start to think of myself. And of course, I'm dragging Ricky with me.
Do you know, are you aware of any injuries by this stage?
Only that everything hurt. I mean, from the toenails on my feet, the hairs on the top of my head, everything in between just ached.
So did those bullets hit you?
No, and it wasn't until later when the gun was actually inspected and recovered by a proper firearms team that they found out they were blanks.
Right, but psychologically it's exactly the same. It now explains, you've explained it brilliantly, by the way, it explains the reason why you were able to do everything. It doesn't take away from the fear and trepidation and psychological effect that gun firing six times would have on you, whether it had bullets or blanks. It's the same in terms of the way your head reacts to it emotionally. So I'm going to cut forward a second, partly because the show is primarily about forensics, although it leads into other things. Sorry to interrupt. So let's try and move this forward as quickly. You've got the guy in handcuffs. You've got him outside. Then we get to a point much further down the line, which is about the lack of understanding what you've been through. Now, I know that's jumping ahead, but in your own words, try and compress what happened next in terms of your job and then what happened to you emotionally.
When I got back to the police station that very same night, my entire team were there because they'd heard it all over the radio. And immediately they started to tell me what they would have done in that situation. They didn't really want to hear what I had done. They just wanted to give me their opinion, which was kind of odd. And at the time, I brushed it off. But in actual fact, I think that kind of impact really did some long-term psychological damage. However, certainly my supervisors sort of said, thanks for doing the job. And that was it. That's pretty much forgotten about.
So it was quite low-key in a sense. And I suppose their attitude, rightly or wrongly, was that they weren't real bullets. You've been through, you know, something that was obviously, I'm talking about their perception now, that was obviously, you know, very scary and so on. But it's almost like because they weren't real bullets, that's it, end of story. Is that a fair enough way of describing it?
To a degree, yes. And I think it's also fair to say that if there was nothing to be dealt with at the scene, bearing in mind that I'd recovered the weapon, I dealt with the offender, they were in the cells, there was no injuries or any visible injuries. I think it's the case that most police officers would just move on, next job, and that's the life of being a police officer. There's never a chance to have a downtime between any of the incidents that you attend. You know, for example, so I've been dealing with a sudden death and I've had to comfort a family as to, you know, why their loved one had moved on. And in the very next hour, not even, you know, a chance, is the time from driving between one scene to the next. I was fighting someone who wanted to take my head off. And that's the life of a police officer. It just moves on at a pace.
Right. But the thing in between, the very thing that I know you feel strongly about and you've written a book about, is it's all about the follow-up. It's all about, and weirdly, there is an element of forensics in this because forensics are what you were feeling emotionally, or you didn't realize at the time, it took time to work it out, PTSD, is that, you know, this is something that only came out later. While carrying out the research for my audiobook, I realized that forensic scientists often experience the same feelings that you are describing. Some of them openly acknowledge that their job involves certain sacrifices when it comes to their health. Let's hear about it with an extract from my audiobook.
One distinguished forensic scientist once told me, "We're not machines. We're human beings with hearts and souls, and sometimes all this death and destruction can have a devastating effect on our mental health." Many such scientists admit that often the details of their first few cases rest the most heavily on their minds. Most outside the forensic world tend to presume that once a body is laid out in a laboratory, it becomes nothing more than a slab of dead meat to scientists, enabling them to step back emotionally and do their job. But that's not the case at all. So it's no surprise that forensic scientists suffer from disturbingly graphic nightmares, which can even sometimes impact on their families. Another forensic scientist told me, "My own nightmares nearly always seem to revolve around hands. You often have to remove them to help speed up identification issues. This is rarely discussed publicly because it's something we try to keep quiet out of sensitivity for families of the deceased. But it's a brutal moment when you remove them. It feels as if you're removing part of who they are, and that can be hard to come to terms with." Today, many pathologists believe that after particularly harrowing cases such as mass disasters, serial killings, and spree shootings, forensic scientists should be given a psychological debrief as a matter of course. One forensic scientist I interviewed for this book admitted that he frequently found himself at home with his family, thinking in graphic terms about a murder he was dealing with at work. He explained, "I try so hard not to bring my job home, but inevitably it seeps into everything, even though most of my colleagues claim they can switch off. How can you 100% switch off from some of the scenes of carnage we have to face and smile with your family? It's not easy." Another forensic scientist I recently met told me how he sometimes has flashbacks to the remains of car crash victims, just as he's about to cross a busy road with his family. "It can be hard to cope with. In some ways, I suppose it's like a warning system to be careful, but it often startles me and makes me nervous. Believe me, I really don't want those images invading my home life." So in summary, forensic scientists are human beings like the rest of us.
And this is true for policemen. They are human beings as well, and every incident has an impact on their mental health. In terms of trying to marry up the way that stress is dealt with in the police and the way that the scientific methods of forensics, even though they're looking for clues to murders and clues to attacks and so on, but in this case, they're just the same. They're looking to make sure that presumably the gun was definitely only had blanks, that the gun had been fired. So there are all these elements that are going on, and yet you're sitting in the middle of it and no one's really thinking about your emotional state.
Absolutely. As I say, that was just the life of a police officer. I was expected to come into work the very next night and do my next shift. I was off late because, of course, I was being debriefed and debriefed and debriefed again. So I had a few hours sleep and I was back in at 10 o'clock to do my next shift.
So presumably forensics went to the flat or house where this incident happened to obviously gather up evidence. Were they talking to you about what had happened, or did they just go there to look for clues?
I had nothing. As I say, part of my debriefing at the end of that shift was with CID, and detectives and detective sergeants were coming down. I had the firearms officers there. They're all of them wanting to talk to me. But at 9:30 that morning, so 7.5 hours after all this has happened, I was allowed to go home and go to sleep. CID picked up the job and dealt with it.
Just for our listeners, the CID is the Criminal Investigation Department. What was the follow-up for you? What happened to you after that?
So once I'd written my statement, CID basically just got on with it. And about 3 days later, the DS came and found me and said, "We've charged Ricky. He's been charged with possession of a firearm with intent to cause fear or violence, and also the assaults." That was it. That was my update.
Would it be true to say that the way you reacted might not be the same way that another officer reacted? And I think everything that happens to us in life, stress-wise, it strikes me is down to what we are like rather than what happens to us. So that needs to be taken into account much more, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I can say that after the gun incident that I was involved with, my PTSD didn't fully come out until 3 to 4 years later. And although I was coping at the time, there was something deep inside of me that I couldn't get hold of. And I was still going into work. I was still, you know, picking up a set of car keys, still arresting people, still getting involved in fights. And I think after about 3 or 4 years, I then realized that something wasn't right.
And what was the incident that made you really realize that?
My biggest trigger was that I actually got sent to a criminal damage to a house about 3 doors down from where Ricky used to live. And when I arrived, and that was the very first time in all those years that I'd ever gone back down that road. So I turned up and I couldn't get out of the car. In the back of my mind, I can remember struggling parking the police car. And I was thinking it was a bit odd. And then as soon as I turned the ignition off, I couldn't get out of the car. I couldn't speak. I couldn't think. I had to try and get hold of my supervisor and just say, help. I don't know what I'm doing.
And what was their reaction? What was the reaction of your supervisor?
So my sergeant basically said, get yourself to Centrepoint, which was one of the police offices in the town. Get yourself a cup of tea and sort yourself out.
And that was it?
That was it.
And how did it all evolve after that, over the following hours and days?
So I got back to the police station. I managed to calm myself down. And I spoke to my supervisor. And he basically just looked at me when I was literally opening my heart and telling him everything that was going on and how I was feeling. He just looked at me like I was a bit wet and I wasn't coping. And he said, well, do some paperwork till the end of the shift.
And that was it. And how did you then, subsequently, I don't want to rush ahead because of limited time here, but what then evolved and led you to leave the police?
So I tried several times. I went through all sorts of different therapies to try and get to grips of what I was suffering. And at the time, I didn't know it was PTSD. I thought it was just stress. Rushing forward a number of years and a number of failed therapies, I just couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't put my uniform on and leave the police station and do my job. And after 4 years of struggling with this mental health issue, I was actually asked to leave and I was ill health retired from the police.
And that was it, basically?
That was it, out the door. The funny thing was for about 2 years prior to me being retired, I was disciplined 4 separate occasions for stuff that had happened outside of the police force. And that was all to do with my business and my book. And my book is there to try and help those with stress. But the police didn't like it. And I was disciplined for those matters. Nothing criminal. I'd done nothing illegal. It was just all about my business interest.
That's very interesting. They didn't really like you exposing what happened to you because it would reflect badly on them?
Potentially, but also I think a number of police forces would prefer that someone resigned rather than draw a pension and take money from the coffers of an individual organisation. And I understand that, but my mental health was and still is to a degree in the gutter. I just couldn't cope. Without going into too much detail, because I'm pretty sure that there's a number of your listeners would have heard this. Whilst I was going through a discipline matter and being looked at for ill health retirement, I potentially just lost my career. I lost any source of income. I lost my wife. She disappeared and said, I didn't want anything to do with you anymore. I couldn't afford my mortgage, so I lost my house and I ended up being homeless. I mean, the impact of that one job back in 2011 destroyed and completely changed my life.
So is there a nightmare scenario here that a policeman or a forensic scientist or a soccer officer, whatever, whoever, finds themselves suffering from PTSD in the way you did, not realizing it themselves, and eventually explodes and a tragedy occurs? I'm sure there are examples of this that we don't even know about. And I'm talking about Britain alone here, because I think it's quite clear this has happened in the United States a number of times. So we're sitting on a time bomb, aren't we?
Absolutely. To use my own experience, I knew that I couldn't do operational policing anymore. We used to do what was called an NTE, a nighttime economy, and used to go down to the town on a Friday or Saturday night and deal with drunken people. And there was a point that I was arresting these drunken people, and I realized that I could easily lose it. I could really seriously hurt these people. Not because I wanted to, but because I just couldn't control myself. And it was then that I basically started saying, I really need help.
So you at least recognise that. But what measures should police officers, forensics, and so on, what are the big giveaway signs? I'm being a bit simplistic, I know, but how can they avoid this happening if they're really on the edge, if they've taken a knock and they're possibly suffering from PTSD, but they don't know it yet?
Individuals are all incredibly different. People that in my situation might not have coped so well. They might have coped 10 times better and still be in the police doing frontline operational duties. So it is down to the individual. It's also about the experiences. And I can tell you that in one shift, I probably went through about 4 or 5 very traumatic experiences. A normal member of the public would cower at just one and take them years to get over. And I was doing 3 or 4 of these in a shift. So a CSI who would be going to the more serious crimes and seeing basically death and destruction, if you like, would be exposed to what I was dealing with a lot more. And there's no reprieve. There's no time off. There's no check. There's nobody stood behind you, tap you on the shoulder and asking, are you okay? It's just about you need another job to go to. I think those that can actually do 30 years on the front line, I absolutely take my hat off. And I think they should be given every recognition in the world for what they do. However, those that can't cope, that's where the problem is.
Now I'm going to just switch from your experiences as a police officer before that incident to talk about forensics and SOCO. Here's what I found out about the relationship between forensics and police and how it has developed since the 1990s.
In the mid-1990s, drug-related violence meant that homicide figures were rising fast in the UK, US, and many other nations in the Western world. The narcotics marketplace was highly lucrative, and rival gangs were engaged in indiscriminate, bloody turf wars that often cost innocent bystanders their lives. In order to improve arrest figures at that time, senior officers and Home Office bosses in the UK started putting enormous pressure on police officers and scientists in particular. Politicians demanded improvements in law and order, and large sums of public money were being spent on forensic science laboratories. Following the introduction of DNA fingerprinting and other new forensic science developments, police detectives and the experts alongside them believed they were about to turn a corner and be able to solve cases they would have walked away from in previous times. As a result, the status of forensic scientists was rising to the point where they were being recognized as legitimate investigators. Some of these experts coming through the ranks were fast gaining reputations as clever investigators in their own right. However, this also meant that forensic scientists began being put under enormous pressure by police forces across the UK to come up with results. Many detectives unashamedly leaned on them to solve some of the toughest cases. It started to get very tricky, one former Scotland Yard murder squad detective from that era recalled. A lot of my police colleagues got a bit lazy and put all the pressure onto the forensic boys to solve many of the most serious crimes, especially murder.
So, Carl, I wonder whether you agree with what this former Scotland Yard murder squad detective says. How did or didn't things change during the period you were a police officer? And what was the attitude of your fellow officers towards the SOCO guys and the forensic scientists on a job? What was it like? What were the feelings between them? What was the relationship like between all these separate units?
Well, as I say, when I started, we had police officers as SOCOs, so that they were just police officers that came and helped us to gather evidence that we needed to put people away. However, when I started, it was about finding the offender. And the perfect example of this is on East Sector, which is based in Swindon, when I was a sector officer, we had a number of burglaries, non-dwelling, all of them schools, offices, or building sites. And we didn't have a clue. And all it was people would come and kick down the doors, steal what they wanted and disappear. We'd go out, we'd take details, no CCTV, nothing we could actually trace for anybody. And the only time that we actually got a hit was Socco. His name was Dave. He went out and he managed to get some footprints off of the door, and they were quite a unique hexagonal-shaped pattern on the bottom of the sole. So this went on for about a month. The same pattern kept coming up on all these different building sites, office blocks, schools. And it wasn't until I actually arrested somebody, a well-known shoplifter on East Sector back then. And back then, we used to do something that was called sidecar, which was we used to take the shoes from people and take imprints of the shoes. So again, we could match them up. Now, while I was doing this, I flipped the shoe over of this offender, and there was this really unique hexagonal pattern on the bottom of his shoe. And I was thinking, that's exactly the same. That's got to be it. So because of the Socco managing to get this footprint and me seeing it and being able to then see the shoe, I actually arrested this chap for a number of burglaries. And the result of that was that I managed to get a search authorized and went in his house, and we found overhead projectors from schools set up in his bedroom where he was watching films on his wall. And across the top of the overhead projectors was the actual school's name written in pen. So, you know, it all came together wonderfully. But without Socco, without Dave going out to get that footprint for me, I never would have got him. And he would probably would have got away with it for a long time. So it's a massive amount of what Socco can do for a frontline officer. That really was a perfect job. The problem is now is that cops aren't engaged as much with the offenders or speaking with people. And what they do now is they completely rely on scenes of crime or CSI officers to go out and find the evidence for them, link their offender, and then they can go and arrest them and deal with them. They're no longer the cop that goes out, goes hands-on, identify these things. It's either caught on CCTV, somebody names the suspect, which is great, obviously a witness from the scene, or it comes down to forensics. So it's completely now reliant. It's almost done a 360, and now the CSI leads a lot of the, certainly the big jobs, a lot of it is down to those.
Before we move on to my next question, I'd like us to have a listen to what I discovered about how the relationship between police and forensics developed between the 1950s and the 1970s.
The 1950s saw the nation's crime rate skyrocket. In London, gangs of professional criminals were taking over the streets of the capital. Many of these mobs used murder frequently as a warning to their enemies. The police struggled to get anyone in this chilling new underworld to help them to bring such killers to justice. Certain police officers even ignored forensic scientists on some cases because they were in the pockets of criminals who paid for many such investigations to go away. Even some of the most honest police officers dismissed forensic scientists as getting in the way of their attempts to take the bad men off the streets because they took so long to analyze their findings about murders. One senior Scotland Yard detective said at the time, "It's all very well having those professors on tap, but they're too bloody slow for my liking. In this game, you need to get the bad boys locked up double quick. You can't hang around while some boffin in a white coat juggles test tubes for months on end." Back in those unruly post-war days, some detectives rewrote criminal statements and planted false evidence to secure convictions rather than waiting for the forensic experts to come up with something. Those types of officers saw nothing wrong with faking evidence because they believed it was their duty to convict criminals by any means necessary. Scotland Yard Flying Squad Chief Tommy Butler was a classic example of this mentality. He hated the forensic scientists most of the time and saw them as slowing down his own manic quest for justice. Yet ironically, his biggest claim to fame, 1963's notorious Great Train Robbery, was solved in part thanks to a fingerprint found by forensics on a salt container at the farm where the gang hid out after the robbery. One officer from that era recently told me, "Tommy Butler fucking loathed the forensic boys. I remember one time he tried to get this nerdy type scientist fella to help plant a fingerprint in a bank, which had been robbed by a notorious gang of professional robbers. We all knew one particular crook had been involved in the job. In our minds, there was no harm in making sure he got arrested. But this forensic professor bloke went ballistic at Tommy for even suggesting such a thing. But not even this academic type would report it to the top brass at the yard, because we all worked to the golden rule that you never grassed up your colleagues in those days, whatever they did and whoever you were. But Tommy Butler and that forensic fella never spoke to each other ever again. Forensic scientists regularly walked away from investigations rather than do anything unscientific. But a small minority did cave in to pressure from certain detectives and provide supposed evidence, which would be enough to enable the police to arrest a suspect. There were only a very small number of allegedly crooked forensic investigators, though. The majority were disgusted by the way crooked police officers tried to use them to put away their enemies. This awkward attitude between the police and forensic scientists lasted until at least the mid-1970s.
So would it be fair to say that after that period in the 1980s, police tended to work separately from forensics, or was there some sort of mutual respect between them?
In my opinion, and what I know now, I would suggest that a lot of the stuff that SOCO or scenes of crime or crime scene investigators came up with was seen as being in the way, getting in the way of a fast-paced, moving an operational package that was coming together to try and find the suspect. There was no case law when it went to court to say this person was guilty of this offence because of fingerprints, DNA, footprint impressions. That all came later. So we're right at the beginning of the CSI stuff.
Exactly. So that tells us that crimes such as the Brinksmack robbery and the Security Express robbery in Shoreditch, which I've just mentioned, they would probably be solved very quickly. And ironically, because of the digital age we live in, that they probably wouldn't have been committed in the first place. So all these elements and the closeness between forensics, soccer officers, and the investigative officers has got closer, and that has had a very good effect on preventing crime as well as solving crime.
Certainly in the old school crime, absolutely. You know, crime today is completely different how it's solved to crime many, many years ago. As you say, you've already brought up things about mobile phones. You can track anybody. You can, forensic-wise, DNA-wise, pretty much any surface. Fingerprints as well are checked at every scene. I mean, today, with any scene, it's locked down. It's gone through in with a fine-tooth comb, and not until they know that absolutely every part of the evidence could actually have been scraped from that scene, that it has been, that they release it. Well, many years ago, they wouldn't have shut down an area for 3, maybe 4 days if they had to, while they went over everything. So people now understand the importance of forensics and how that fits into modern day crime solving.
But there's one important element which we haven't yet discussed and which came in before you joined the police force, and that is DNA. It seems to have changed the face of crime, or has it really? Was it seen as a vital breakthrough, or was it seen as just another aspect of forensic science?
DNA was the next big piece of evidence. If your DNA is on something, you've got to explain why it's there. And a number of criminals couldn't, other than to say, it's not mine, Gov. But then the science walks into the court and says, you're one in, I think it's something like 20 million people with this, that kind, that strand of DNA. They can't explain it away, so they end up getting convicted. And to be fair, a number of criminals are not exactly honest, so they're not going to stand there and say, yes, it was me, Gov. But DNA was the clincher in so many jobs that I think a number of other jobs suffered because DNA wasn't there. And if DNA wasn't there and you knew it was the offender, they had an out at court because they said, my DNA wasn't there. So it was a double-edged sword.
So in a way, it obviously led and still leads to more guilty people being prosecuted. But at the same time, what are you saying?
I'm not sure it actually makes more people be convicted of offences. It helps the case. But if DNA is not found at a serious crime and a suspect who has done it, let's say, doesn't have their DNA located either by luck or they were incredibly focused about not dropping anything, they will get off at court because if they say my DNA's not there, I wasn't there.
So it's very interesting. What you're saying is it's almost like it's the clincher, but if it's not there, the police, in some cases, I don't want to generalize too much, but in some cases are not really bothering once they realize that although this guy might be guilty, his DNA wasn't there, so they don't think they've got a hope in hell of prosecuting him, so they give up.
What I think is that policing has changed. I think a lot of police officers are so reliant on forensics that they forget about how to be a good copper. And being a good copper means getting on the streets, knocking on doors, speaking to people. And I think that element's beginning to be lost now because of the reliance on evidence that can be scraped from a scene. Rather than dealing with the suspect, dealing with witnesses, knocking on doors, speaking to, and, you know, everyone knew what a snitch was back then. Informants, people that actually knew what was going on because they were in those circles. Informants are not used so much anymore. And as you know, that a number of big-time robberies and big jobs that were have done over time was actually solved by using informants. That doesn't get used anymore. That's no longer part of everyday policing because if an informant says they've done it and they've got no evidence, it's just hearsay. So that's why they now heavily rely on forensics because it places people at the scene rather than, oh, I heard on the grapevine that it was Sid that did it. So, yeah, I think there's a massive loss of old-style coppering.
So forensics are a blessing and a curse.
Exactly.
And that is very intriguing because everybody sees it, forensic science, as the thing that's made crime fighting more efficient, but there is another side to it, and it's fascinating to discuss this. Now, what about the future relationship between the police and forensic scientists? Do you think they'll end up being one entity?
From what I know of, let's call them CSIs, they actually work from a police station anyway. So they're actually employed by a police force to go to scenes, scrape the scenes, and find evidence. They already have a good working relationship with police officers. You know, they carry police radios, they drive police vans. When they turn up, a lot of police officers give them respect because they know it's an art, if you like. And a number of crime scene investigators now have to have degrees with lots of experience just to come and deal with a scene. And I think that recognition is good, but whether it's healthy is another question. And only time will tell as to how much reliance will be placed on scene analysis.
Well, this reliance issue is very important because in America, there have been a lot of wrongful convictions where forensic labs have incorrectly analyzed things, which have resulted in inaccurate results. It looks as if there are beginning to be a few examples of this popping up here in the UK. Now, there's not a lot we can do to stop this, but it sort of ominously goes back to what you've been saying just now, doesn't it?
It's very difficult because a lot of case files that I've seen is based on, I call it, good, proper, solid police work, knocking on doors, getting your leads, checking CCTV, finding registration plates of vehicles, associates, using all sorts of, you know, just policing skills that you need. And it's nice to see that a majority of police files contain that amount of work, certainly in the UK. And then it's the forensics that are on top that is almost like an icing over the top of the cake. And providing the cake underneath that icing is still substantial, when it goes to court, it doesn't rely solely on forensics. Yes, there are cases that are out there, but the majority of them now are still the donkey work, the police work underneath it. So I guess it's about how you deal with the scene, how you deal with the suspect, and how you deal with your witness, stroke, victim, if the victim's still alive. And it's those three elements basically key for you to get a strong case. Now, if forensics mess up, you've still got the other two. And it would be interesting to see later on if a forensic would come back as incorrect and the case file reopened and they see the amount of work that was done on it, whether it's informants, whether it's surveillance or anything behind it, whether that wouldn't actually stand up to a solid conviction of that individual.
What about your own opinion in terms of the way the police generally, we've discussed, dealt with your experiences of stress, but also generically across the board? Do you think that the way that victims of crime are treated and interviewed, and when I say victims of crime, I'm including police officers, has to change in order for these elements that you yourself have suffered from are properly dealt with?
There has been a recognition of victim awareness, certainly over the last 10, possibly even 15 years, which is where they recognised victims of serious assault or sexual assault, and also children either being witnesses or victims of crime, so that they actually have specialist trained officers. I was one of them, to deal with vulnerable people.
Let's go from the real world for a minute to the world of television. My podcast, The Real Silent Witnesses, is obviously a play on the title of the BBC hit drama, The Real Silent Witness. Thinking back to your own experiences with forensic scientists and SOCAD officers, how does it compare to reality?
Anything on the TV doesn't compare to reality. Not even the Fly on the World documentary where they're 24 hours in police custody. It just doesn't reflect it. And the reason being is because things don't happen that quick. And when there's a documentary with a fly on the wall, you probably only get an hour's worth of viewing, or probably 45 minutes. Well, for 23 hours and 15 minutes outside of that documentary, it's mundane police work. It's about trudging through everything, ticking all the boxes, making sure you're doing it, knocking on the doors, going out there doing the donkey work that just doesn't get covered. And there's usually, certainly in 24 hours, there's a huge team, and the ones they concentrate on are probably the ones that are quite happy to chat to the camera. But normally there's probably about 20 or 30 people behind the scenes helping them. On top of that, anything that's written, let's talk about fictional police series, they can make anything up. And most crooks out there now are fairly switched on, and they understand what they need to do and how they need to do it to get away with it. Crime is changing. People are no longer walking into banks with guns or anything else, or threatening cashiers to hand over the cash. That's ridiculous now. The amount of CCTV, forensics and everything, people know there's no point doing it.
Wow. Carl Jones, that fascinating chat. And thank you for being on the Real Silent Witnesses podcast.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the Real Silent Witnesses, Police and Forensics. In the last hour, I've chatted with former policeman Carl Jones about how mental health issues used to be dealt with within the police force, and about the relationship between forensics and police, which has evolved throughout the years. I think Carl has made some very good points today. Speaking of his experiences dealing with PTSD, it struck me how mental health issues have sometimes been downplayed within the force, and how policemen are just expected to go on to their next assignment. As Carl left the force a decade ago, I'd be interested to know if this is still the case. I'm just hopeful that the police have become more sensitive and supportive towards their staff. As for DNA analysis, what he said about it being a double-edged sword made me reflect on what an important element DNA has become. Maybe too important, as the police so often rely on it to bring criminals to justice. Obviously, the views and thoughts I've expressed in this podcast are entirely my own. It's a free world. You can think whatever you want. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you like the show, we would appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend about it. For a more in-depth analysis into forensics, check out my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses, which is available at all good stores, including Audible and Apple Books, published by WF House. And remember, the dead tell us everything.